My name is David Paulson. I'm a member of the Society for American Baseball Research. Today is November 20th. I'm in the home of Ernest Burke in Pikesville, Maryland. We're sending a copy of this tape to the Hall of Fame, but Sabre reserves the right to distribute the tape or transcriptions of the interview to other researchers and post it on the internet. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, well, you were supposed to give me some kind of release or something like that.
Well, this my wife and you give me the release. In other words, this is the release.
Yeah, well.
I'll send you a copy of the tape.
Okay.
All right. A couple weeks ago, you mentioned that you invited me to a baseball dinner in Baltimore.
Yeah.
I wasn't able to make it, but could you just tell me a little about that dinner or what it was about?
We honored L. Rod Hendricks at the Boosters Club. And we had Flanagan and numerous of ball players there. Some I didn't know and some I did. And we had about 2,000 people. And it really turned out good.
2,000? Where was it held?
It held at a big hotel that just built. They just built it down in the Inner Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so sorry I couldn't make it.
Yeah.
Sounded like a great affair.
Yeah, it was.
Okay. How old are you?
78.
Okay, and where were you born?
I was born in Perryville, Maryland.
Okay. Any brothers or sisters?
One brother, one sister, and they're both deceased.
Were they older than you?
Older than I. Mm-hmm.
Right. And did you grow up in Perryville?
No. My mother died when I was quite young, and between Fort Deposit and Canada, I grew up till the Second World War, and then I came back to the States and volunteered for the Marine Corps because President Roosevelt opened the doors for no branches of service should be segregated. And I always knew that the Marine Corps had the best and wanted the best. And I wanted to be the best, so I volunteered for the Marine Corps.
Okay. Let's go a little back to your childhood a little bit. And you say you grew up partially in Canada?
Yeah.
Where in Canada?
A little town called St. James, Quebec, Canada.
In the province of Quebec?
Yeah.
And did you play baseball up there?
No, I was a skier. I skied a lot. I never started playing baseball, believe it or not, until I went into the Marine Corps. Actually, started playing.
Did you go to high school in Canada?
No.
Back in Perryville.
I only went as far as the seventh grade, and that's it.
And after the seventh grade, but before you went to the Marine Corps,
lived up in Canada and skied, and our parents had a grocery store. We used to work in there, the boys and I. We all worked in there.
Okay. Now, you joined the service, what, about 41 or 42?
43.
Uh-huh. And where did you have basic training?
Down at Marford Point, North Carolina. Which is Camp Lejeune.
Camp Lejeune, right.
Yeah.
Okay, and it was about that time that you started playing baseball?
Well, I was in service overseas when I started playing baseball. And it was just a natural thing, you know. Anything I wanted to do as far as sports concerned, it just stepped in line. You know, I just did it, you know.
Where were you overseas?
I was in Guadalcanal, Okinawa, Guam.
So you probably saw some combat there.
Oh, yeah.
And what was your rank in the service?
I was a corporal.
Now,
I was made corporal from private to lieutenant. A Pearl, and I'd been there for, I guess, about 6 or 8 months, and Washington sent a blueprint over with some majors and colonels to put an amphibious tank. I put a mine destroyer on an amphibious tank, and that was my department. And when we put it on, the way the blueprint read, it didn't work. So I told the colonel, I said, I think we could make this thing work. So he said, if you can, go ahead and give it a shot. So it was two other white lads and myself. We changed a few items and put it together, and I ran it over a mine and blew it up and run it out in the sea with an amphibious tank. And I had a technical rating sent from Washington to Pearl Harbor. I jumped from private to corporal. So
I guess you're mechanically inclined.
Yeah.
Okay, so this was at Pearl Harbor around 1943?
Yeah, later part of 43.
Yeah. Okay. Now, had you started playing baseball at that time?
No.
Not yet?
No. No. I started playing baseball when I was down on Okinawa.
Okay, so that would have been around 45.
Yeah, 45. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I walked out on the field one day, and they, everything was discriminated, even down in service. We got this team together, and they could see I had a real good fastball, so, and good control. And they said, well, you'll be the pitcher. So we had one white lieutenant. He came and joined the team. And that was very, very rare, you know, for a white person being on a black team with all this discrimination.
Was he the only white person?
Yeah, only one. And
so he desegregated.
Yeah. And so we played, and we won the championship in that area.
Is that just Okinawa or other islands?
No, just in that island. And what happened, all the ex-pros went in service. They were in social service. And they didn't go in the field, you know. All they did was surface service. And so they had a team. So we used to play them, and we beat them the most of the time.
Were these guys who had played major league ball?
Oh yeah. That's what I said. Yeah, because when they went in service, they didn't go. They didn't do anything.
No combat.
Just a very few of them that volunteered. And
now you're a right-hander.
Right-hander.
Okay.
I throw right and bat left.
Oh, that's the way to do it. Rather the other way around.
This young man that was in the CBs, he pitched for the White Sox. His name was Johnny Rigney.
Yeah.
Maybe you heard of him.
Yeah. It was also Bill Rigney.
Johnny Rigney. He was a pitcher for the White Sox. And he said that, as good as you pitch and the things you can do, you ought to join the Negro League. Well, I never knew anything about the Negro League, you know, because where I was raised. And
you
so
really had
so
no
forth.
Baseball background at all?
No. Uh-uh. So when I got out of service in
1946,
I came to Havre Grace, and my brother lived there, and I stayed a couple of months there with him. And they had a little team there they called the Havre Grace Black Sox. So,
semi-pro team?
Just a scrub team, you know. And we came to Baltimore and Buell Field to play one night, little local team in Baltimore. And I caught a ball in right field and threw it to second base and knocked the second baseman's glove off. So the next 2 days, the Baltimore League Giants was up there signing me up.
Now, in the service, you said you started off as a pitcher, but here you became an outfielder.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so was there a scout or somebody in the stands or something that had heard about it?
Well, the owner was there of the Baltimore League Giants because they didn't own the stadium, but they rented the stadium, And he was always there when games was played, Vernon Green. And the business manager, he was there. So they seen all of this and seen me hit the ball. And
was this in 46 or 47?
46.
46.
Okay. Yeah.
And you joined the team right away?
Yeah, right away.
Now, the crowds generally, how large were the crowds?
The crowds, did they run maybe 1,500, 2,000? They had good crowds.
Were the games basically in the daytime, or did you play night games?
Night games and day games. We had lights and everything. You know.
Now, when you joined the team, who were some of the better players on the team?
Well, Campanella went up the year just when I went there. And then at the end of the season, him and Don Newcomb came back. And we played the old Orioles, or the Birds. They were over on, it wasn't 23rd Street, but they were at a park over here in that area somewhere. And they used to play a seven-game series with us.
Was this another black team? Or
no, white team. White team. This is, I think they were affiliated with Pittsburgh Parks or something like
this
that.
This is minor league.
Yeah, yeah. And what I often tell people that it was so hard that they would come over and play seven games at Bugle Field, and we dared not to go over on their field and play one or two games. You know, when you play seven-game playoff, you play a couple here and a couple there, but it wasn't done that way here in Baltimore.
You weren't ready for it.
No, no.
So were you always the home team, or did they let the Baltimore team be the home team once in a while? You played all the games at Bugle Field.
Yeah, against them, yeah.
Yeah, but were you always the home team?
Well, it reversed. They would be home team sometimes, and we would be home team. And another thing, you know, that a lot of people don't understand, we had a lot of whites came to Bugle Field to watch us play, and they were never segregated. They could sit anywhere they wanted to. But when we went, our black went to a major league game or a minor league game, they were always set out in the bandbox somewhere out there. They were already segregated.
So organized baseball had the segregation, but the black home teams did not.
No, did not.
Bugle Field, was that located in a predominantly black area, or was it?
No, it was mostly white until later on in years when the black starts moving. It was over in East Baltimore on Irvin Avenue. Or Central Avenue, one of the streets.
Was that near Patterson Park? Or
Yeah, it wasn't too far from. No, Patterson Park, no. No.
Okay, so that first year, were you primarily a pitcher or you played the outfield?
But when I joined the Baltimore League Giants, I was strictly a pitcher. And I pitched on the road all the time because. Here they had special pitchers that pitch home. The real good pitchers usually pitch their home, you know, and the other pitchers are. And as of myself, I just joined the team, and I pitched on the road, you know, away from home.
Right. Now, when they signed you up, was there any such thing as a bonus?
No.
And what kind of salary did you get?
I got $250 a month. And I got $2 a day for eating money every time we went on a road trip. That's everybody.
And how many players were on the team,
approximately? Possibly, I guess it was 29 or 30.
Oh, so it was at least as many as the major.
Well, yeah, it was the same identical thing. See, that's what people does not understand about the Negro League. That everything was the same as the major league. But the only difference was the color of her skin. It's the only difference.
And about you were basically a starting pitcher?
Yeah.
Did he have relief pitchers then? Basically the starters were expected pretty much to go the whole way.
Yes, when they went in, they got pitched 9 innings. Some of them got bombed and had to come out and get a relief pitcher, but the most pitchers pitched 9 innings.
And I guess the relief pitcher was probably a secondary starter.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't really primarily a relief pitcher.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that first year in 46, do you remember how you did? Ended up?
Well, I think I won about 10 or 12 games, and I lost four or five, something like that.
That was in 46, then next year you were still with the Giants, 47?
47, yeah.
And also in 48?
Yeah.
Right. Now, did they have playoffs or World Series or anything like that?
Yes. We never made the playoffs till 49. And I wasn't there in 49. I was in Canada.
We'll get to that.
Okay.
Right. So, any other well-known players in your 47 and 48 other than Newcomb and...
Well, I tell you, our...
The fellas maybe didn't make the majors.
Yeah, well, Joe Blank and Junior Gilliam, they made the majors in Campanella. But we had people such as Johnny Weissman, the first baseman. We had Egghead Clark, who was a catcher. He taught Campanella everything he knew about catching, and he never made it. We had another center fielder by the name of Henry Kimbrough, was the best center fielder I ever seen. I had another player by the name of Lester Lockett. He played right field, and he could hit that ball a country mile. We had Bill Bird. He was a spitball pitcher, and he was excellent. It was the opportunity was there. He should have made it. And I just go down the list. It's been so long, I forgot half the guys' names and things like that. But the guys who were really close to me, like the guys I named, I can remember.
Did you play against... I guess you wouldn't have played against Jackie Robinson. He was probably already in there.
Well, no, we didn't ever play against Jackie Robinson because he was only here for a year in Kansas City. And we didn't make it out there that year when he was with Kansas City.
How about Satchel Paige? You ever played against him?
No, I never played against Satchel Paige.
Josh Gibson?
Josh Gibson, yes. Now, we had Frazier Robinson. That's another man she made the majors in catching, because he used to catch Satchel Paige a lot. He was an excellent catcher.
Okay, now we come to 1949. How did you get into organized baseball?
Well, in 48, I got my release from the Orioles.
Had you asked for the release, or they?
No, they gave me a release, and I was supposed to go to California, and I turned that down. So I went to Poughkeepsie, New York.
That was the Colonial League.
Yeah, and I played up there. I played, I pitched and also played third base and outfield. Then I went from there to Kingston, New York.
Now, when you went to Poughkeepsie, first, were they affiliated with a major league team at that time?
No.
Okay.
No.
Did you get any kind of bonus, signing bonus?
No. What we did, I don't know about anybody else. Again, I got $250 a month, and Algo got $75 under the table.
Okay. Did you get a little more money for meals?
Not really, because... We never went that far. We only went to Bridgeport, Waterbury, and Kingston. It was just...
Was that Kingston, Ontario?
Yeah. Okay. No, Kingston, New York.
New York. Okay.
New York, yeah. And it was just, just a one couple of hours tour, you know.
Was that a Class D league or C?
Class D.
Okay, you were primarily a pitcher in that league?
Yeah.
Okay.
Pitcher and outfielder. Yeah.
Now, their rosters probably were not as large as the Baltimore League Giants, I guess, were. things?
No, it wasn't. I just forget how many ball players we had, but it wasn't as large. And then a lot of guys, they didn't go on road trips because they had jobs. And the only time they played when we played home.
So they were part-time ball players?
Yeah.
Then in 1950, you went to St. John or St.
John's? St. John's.
That was in Canada.
Yeah.
Were all the teams in Canada in that league, the provincial league?
No. I played in the provincial league, and there was three or four teams up in Winnipeg and played. I never got up there, but a lot of black ball players went up in Winnipeg and played. They had, I think Bankhead was the manager up there, and Willie Wells, he was the manager up there. He was a third baseman, and Bankhead was a shortstop, and they were very good players because Wells played with the Eli Giants, and Bankhead played with the Homestead Grays along with
Well, you had a good year there. You batted
yeah.
308.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you played a little third base, too, as well as the outfield.
Third base.
For pitchers, you were in the most games, 37
yeah.
games. That led the league.
Uh-huh.
Your winning percent, 15 wins, 3 losses.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That led the league in percentage. And then you gave up the most earned runs, which was 92. And was that the 15-3? That was probably the best pitcher in the league then.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the year we won the pennant up there, too.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Were there playoffs first? Or
Yeah, playoffs and then the pennant. Yeah, yeah.
I guess that was an 18 league? 18? Yeah.
I think it was.
Do you remember any players you played with or against when it was prominence?
It's been so long ago.
Right, over half a century.
And these guys is... I was the only black guy on there, and we didn't socialize that much, you know. And, you know, even down in the 50s, and when I played in up in New York, you know, it was still discrimination, and it wasn't supposed to be, you know. A lot of times, we play ball together, and I couldn't go to restaurants and eat where they eat.
Even up in that area?
Yeah, yeah. It's in New York.
That's not me, New York.
Yeah, uh-huh. And a lot of people say New York and all the upstate places, cities, they wasn't segregated, but, you know, they were.
How about your teammates? Did you have any particular problems? Did they get along basically? I mean, did they got along with you?
Well, you know, I always was the easiest guy in the world to get along with, you know, because I always carried myself in that manner, not unless you did me wrong, you know, and defended me one way or the other, and otherwise I just got along with everybody, you know. Only one thing, even down in Poughkeepsie, New York, we had a manager up there. He just got there. And he's from Fifth Harbor in New Jersey. His name was Steve Mizorak. His son was a great pool shooter. You've seen him on TV and different things like that. Mizorak, Steve Mizorak. And he came to me one day, and he says, Ernest, do you mind just using one towel? Instead of using the towel that everybody else used, or do you mind getting a dipper and drink water instead of drinking out of the fountain like everybody else? I said, anything pleases you, okay. It doesn't make any difference to me here. I said, I'm here to do one thing, to play ball, and to hell with everything else. I said, I don't care whether you like me or I like you. I said, I'm here to do one thing, and that's play ball. I said, I've been through enough in shit and misery to not let something like this upset me.
Okay, then the next year you also played the same team, the same league.
Yeah.
And you won 8 games, lost 8 that year.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, did they give raises in the minors, or you kept pretty much the same salary? I mean, since you had an excellent year the year before.
Well, they raised the salary, but the salary was a standing thing in that one particular league. And you get paid under the table, you know, because the contract or the league called for one particular, one maximum salary cap, yeah. But you also got, you know, a little wheeling and dealing under the table, you know, because I had a lot of teams that wanted me, you know, to play for them. But when they dealt under the table, you know, I just stayed there.
Okay, now that was your last, 51 was your last year.
Yeah.
With the provincial team,
Provincial
league.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what did you do after that? Because that was your last year.
I stayed up in Canada for a while, and then I came back here, and I got a job with Eastern Company. They had a dump truck outfit, and they built the Inner Harbor. And I drove a dump truck for, I guess, 4 or 5 years.
Did you still play baseball, pick up games locally? Right?
Yes. I played a little ball with different places since I was in the professional. Sometimes I would go home up in Haverty Grace and play ball, and that was a drawing card for them, you know.
You were drawing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. See me come and play ball or come and pitch, and they made more money for uniforms and for schools and different things like that, you know. I never charged them anything, you know, because they were doing a good deed, whatever they were doing, you know. And I just circled around like that and went to different teams and played. And then I start to try to do coach Little League here in Baltimore. And honest to God, the parents, I just couldn't handle the parents. When the parents start cussing at the kids and telling me where they should play and where their kids should play and so on and so forth, I couldn't handle that. And basically, I love kids. I love kids. I don't care what color they are. I still love them. And when they start cussing at the kids, even though they're their own kids, it got next to me, you know. So I quit that. I said, I've been doing something I had no business doing, and wind up in jail or something.
Were those little league teams segregated also at that time?
No, back there, no. That's when I came down.
This
was late 50s.
So you helped build the Inner Harbor.
Huh?
You helped build the Inner Harbor.
Oh, yeah.
I see you're wearing a U.S. Tennis Association sweatshirt. How did you get involved with tennis? Because I see you're a tennis instructor.
Well, when I retired, or just before I retired, I retired when I was 62. And just before I retired, I went on to tennis. I always could play tennis, but I never taken it seriously. Because skiing was my biggest thing, you know. So I went on a tennis court with a couple of friends of mine, and they wanted to play doubles. So they asked me to play. I said, well, I didn't want to play, you know. So they said, yeah, come on, we need a fourth. So I played. And then the next week, they invited me over. A couple of boys called me up, told me they were going to the court. It must have been set up because they were another man short for having four players. So I played, and I had a lot of white friends at different clubs that I worked out in that was pros, tennis pros. And they said, you know, as good as you play tennis, you ought to go to school and get your degree and become a tennis pro. And I said, you know, it's a good idea. So when I retired, I went to Hilton Head to Vandermeer.
Oh, yeah.
Vandermeer.
Yeah, South Carolina.
Yeah. And And I went through school down there and got my certificate, and I started teaching tennis.
How long a course was that down there?
Huh?
How long was the court, the instruction course?
It was 3 weeks. 3 weeks. Because you had the skill to play tennis, but it was just the idea of touching up and knowing how to talk to people and how to get the best out of them, you know.
So do you still teach tennis?
No, not now. Since I hurt my leg, I'm not able to do anything. That's what makes me so depressed sometimes, because when I pulled a muscle in my leg, it just cut everything off, just cut it off, you know. I can't do anything. I can't walk, I can't run, I can't do anything.
Now, you showed me your room the other day with all the great pictures and photographs and letters of commendation. Tell me some of the things you do now.
But right now, I go to colleges and high schools and give lectures about my past, about my history.
And, about what we've been talking about.
Yes. The Marine Corps, discrimination I went through in the Marine Corps to be a Marine and to fight for your country and you be discriminated. You go to the front line and you fight, and you come back for a rest period and you're discriminated. You know, you die together, you bleed together, you eat together, and then when you come back to the rest camp, you're discriminated, you know, and things like that, you know. And those are the things I tell the kids, you know, that what I went through and what it did to me, it made a man out of me. It made me respect other people, regardless of what color they are. It made me respect other people because I didn't want to treat other people the way I was treated. So, and I try to tell other people what I went through so it would help them to communicate with other people.
Okay, now, I know you were over at the Smithsonian. They had some sort of special ceremony.
Yeah.
About that.
I was called by CNN to interview me. They wanted me to be the guest speaker at the Smithsonian building over in Washington for Jackie Robinson's 50th anniversary. And that was quite a deal. I was so proud of myself being selected to go over there to speak that I broke down and cried, because all the things I could think about, here's a little boy that came from nothing and up here speaking to the whole United States like the president, and it was quite moving.
The president was there?
No, he wasn't there. But it's just like the president. I got papers from different cities and things in there.
And then you did go to the White House for something, didn't you?
Yes.
What was that?
I went to the White House. I had a special tour in the White House. I give a lecture over in Washington, one of the colleges not too far from the White House. And it was a group of teachers, and there was three or four CIA. We're going to the lights. And one came up after everything was over. I opened for questions and everything, and after that was over, one of the ladies came up to me and asked me if I'd ever been to the White House. And I said, no. He said, would you like to go? I said, I most certainly would. So she said, well, I'll give you a call in the next couple of days. And which she did. And she asked me how many did I want to bring. I said, my wife, my grandson, and I. And she said, well, get their social security numbers and call me back. We'll see what we can do. And that I did. And then she set it up for me to tour the White House. I had a special tour. There's nobody but the three of us. and we went places that nobody else could go, and I'd taken pictures that nobody else could take. It was I signing autographs in the White House, and it was quite something. It was quite moving to me.
You mentioned that you didn't play against Jackie Robinson. Did you ever get an opportunity to meet him?
Yes, I met him. Same way when he was Montreal, and goes right back to what I said before, when he was in Montreal and he came to Baltimore to play the Orioles, he couldn't stay downtown. He had to come up in a black neighborhood to go to the hotel up in Dolphin and Madison Avenue called the York Hotel. That was a big prominent hotel for blacks to stay. All the stars that came here to put on shows, that's where they stayed, at the York Hotel. And I met Jackie three or four times when he came here to play ball against the Orioles. Yeah. And he was a gentleman, he was nice. And as I said in all my speeches, when his name comes up, I said, there, as far as a black ball player is concerned, there is not a pedestal high enough that you could put him on. Because if it wasn't for him, there wouldn't be a black ball player in the major leagues. And I think a lot of ball players that's in the major leagues forget about that. Because as I said, I was listening to the news and it upset me so bad that I even down forgot the guy's name. He was being interviewed on TV, a black
major league
ball player. And the announcer asked him, what about Jackie Robinson? That dumb, he didn't even know who Jackie Robinson was. And what's so great about Jackie Robinson, he said. So that cut the show off right there.
Showed out of ignorance. It's probably so many ball players these days just don't know too much about the history of the game.
No.
It's easy to follow.
Same way with me. I go up to some of the ball players and say, you know, I played in the Negro League and I played for the Baltimore League Giants. I played with this guy and that guy and Larry Doby. I played against Larry Doby, a guy like that. And they just pass it off just like you dropped a spoon of sugar or something. You know, they don't pay no attention to you, you know. And another thing that I talked to Frank Robinson, I talked to Ernie Banks, and I talked to several black guys is in the majors, and I said, you know, if you guys would give 1% of your pay to the Negro League, the widowers and the old guys would get along like two peas in a pod. You know, they would live on Easy Street.
And not only that, it'd be deductible.
Yeah, that's true. That's another thing I tell them. It's deductible. I got a thing in there and there where a Sun paper interviewed me, and that was my main subject about if they would give 1% of their pay to the Negro League, you know, how much we would accomplish, you know.
Could you give me your all-star team of players you played with or against in each position?
Run it by me again?
Your all-star team, in other words, the catcher, the pitcher, the people you either saw or played against, played with.
Well,
your opinion,
I'd say Campanella. I would say, quite naturally, Robinson, you know, Larry Doby, and the people that didn't make it, I'd say Joyce Gibson, Henry Kimbrough, or Monty Irvin, he made it. Monty Irvin, and oh, crap, if I thought, you know, nine names would pop in my mind, I could keep you here all day telling you about different ball players. You know.
Now, how is baseball different today than
when you
played?
Well,
the game.
It's no question how baseball has changed. I mean, you know, the pitching mound, they cut it down. It was high, and they cut it down. And now you can't brace your guy off. The pitcher can't brace your guy off because you get thrown out of the game. Or if he hits a guy, the whole dugout turns out, and they have a free-for-all. I've seen guys get hit, white and black. I've seen guys get hit and get knocked out, and nobody moved out of the dugout. But now no sooner you hit a guy, he's going to charge out there with his bat, and then the whole two dugouts, they're going to charge out there, you know. And then yet and still they say, when I get a finger hurt, I'm on disabled list for 2 weeks. But yet and still they can go out there and push and shove each other and they might end up getting a leg broke or eye put out or something like that, you know.
When you played, did you have any superstitions?
Nah. Yeah. When I first joined the Baltimore League Giants, I wore number 13 for almost a year. Then I got number 28, Campanella's old number, and I wore that the balance of the time I was there. I seen some guys now, they don't step on the third base line. They have to walk a certain way, you know, because they're superstitious.
All right, so now you're just, basically what you do now is you speak when you're at the various schools and colleges.
Mm-hmm.
Go to these events.
As a matter of fact, I had a young man that come down from Delaware the day before yesterday. And he was so shocked when he walked back in that room.
Oh, yeah.
I guess he didn't say anything for almost half an hour. That's what he said. And he interviewed me. He came here about 11 o'clock. I think he left about 3:30. And he's going to put it in the Delaware newspaper. He's down here.
I guess he'll send you a copy.
Yeah.
That'll go up to him, too.
That's what he says. Said he's going to send a photographer down because he definitely wants a picture of that room with me in there. So I said, okay.
Okay, Warren, so I certainly enjoyed talking to you today.
And I appreciate
really it. Really, a lot of great information here.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.